It is Thursday, January 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump has threatened to cancel his scheduled meeting with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. Defense Secretary James Mattis prepares to travel to East Asia for meetings with officials in South Korea and Japan.
My sense is the immediate challenge from the administration is going to come from North Korea.
And we look at the new crime adventure film, Gold. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump Thursday said he would cancel a planned upcoming meeting with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto if he continues to refuse to pay for a border wall. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by White House correspondent Cindy Sain. Well, Cindy, apparently the latest news is that the Mexican president has canceled that meeting.
Yes, that's right, Sarah. This really is breaking news. And we've had what might be a Twitter showdown with, as you say, President Trump first tweeting Thursday morning saying that if Mexico is going to continue to refuse to pay for the wall, which Trump says is so badly needed, then he may as well not come. And just a few moments ago, we had the Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, tweeting that they have told the White House that the meeting, the working meeting on Tuesday, will not take place. So this is real blockbuster news.
Yeah, well, where does this leave, then, the whole project to construct this wall?
Well, I guess the plans will go ahead with the Department of Homeland Security. President Trump says that no real new law is needed. He can use the law that was passed before about border security. And he had to more or less concede that first the U.S. would pay up front, saying that Mexico would somehow pay later on or would reimburse. So I guess they will continue with plans for the wall. But the whole thing about negotiating with the U.S. next-door neighbor, Mexico, and negotiating trade agreements and pulling out of NAFTA and all this now is in doubt.
Well, earlier today, Mr. Trump tweeted about federal whistleblower Chelsea Manning. What did he say about Manning?
Well, he said that Manning was totally not grateful for the sentence commutation that she had received from President Obama, and that it was shameful, and that President Obama should not have commuted her sentence in the first place. So that was an early morning tweet by President Trump.
Well, in addition, Mr. Trump is having a busy day today. He will be meeting with British Prime Minister Theresa May. What will be the focus of those two leaders' discussions?
Well, we know that President Trump is on his way to Philadelphia, and he will be speaking at Republican lawmakers, where Theresa May will also be. Now, we know that she will be meeting with the president Friday at the White House, and we've just learned that they will also be having a joint news conference. And there again, trade is going to be one of the top issues, as, of course, Britain is leaving the EU, and Trump has promised to do a special one-on-one trade deal with the United Kingdom. But May is also finding herself coming under pressure from opposition and conservative members of Parliament back at home, calling on her to stand up to President Trump about his latest remarks on torture, with Trump saying that torture does work.
Yeah, and it's interesting that she's attending a Republican retreat.
Yes, Democrats have protested that and said that it was partisan and that should not have happened, but she is.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Cindy. My thanks to White House correspondent Cindy Sain. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending today?
Well, this is more of a story about who is trending than what is trending. So, obviously, as we heard from Cindy, the president is still tweeting about various things. But a lot of U.S. executive agencies, departments are not. The EPA, I should not use the alphabet soup, Health and Human Services, the Department of Agriculture, the Environmental Protection Agency, other agencies have basically been instructed not to send out press releases, not to tweets, not to have really any kind of outside communications for the time being. One presumes until the Trump teams can kind of assess what they want the messages to be and that sort of thing. So what we've seen is some in the federal government not very happy about that. So, for example, the White House instructed agencies not to tweet anymore about climate change and that sort of thing. Well, people at with the National Park Service, specifically Badlands National Park a few days ago, decided to heck with that. They were going to start tweeting about climate change and global warming anyway. Well, the White House put an end to that, but now they there has been created a rogue Twitter account. It's called Alt US Nat Park Service. Huh. It's a Twitter account that's run by Park Service employees, but they make very clear they don't do any of this on company time. It's all in their own private time. So it's really quite perfectly legal. And it is skyrocketing in the number of people that are following it. But they're basically saying, okay, you're going to shut off the formal National Park Service Twitter account. We're going to go ahead and open our own, and there's nothing you can do. And they have now been followed, actually, by employees at NASA. There is a new Twitter account. Let me dig it up here. Alt NASA. It's at alt underscore NASA. This, too, is run by NASA employees who have been instructed not to communicate or tweet or talk to members of press or Congress about global warming or the kind of earth science research that they conduct. Well, apparently a bunch of employees have gotten together there and said, well, to heck with that. And we're going to go ahead and do it anyway. We're going to do it on our own time with our own resources. And from what I could tell, I mean, perhaps a little unclear, but I think mostly the consensus is that this is perfectly legal. You know, that a federal employee, a civil servant, while they're on the job, they are working for the public. That's why we call them civil servants. And there is a chain of command and there are things that you can do. But when these people leave their office and they go home, they are citizens and they can speak their mind. And clearly that's what they're doing.
Well, and also social media is so new. There's probably not a lot of precedents for this.
There's not. I think we're going to see probably agencies and lawmakers, you know, try and kind of crack down and define precedent maybe. But a lot of that's probably going to have to go through the courts anyway.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Global markets are mixed after the Dow closed above 20,000 for the first time. A Kenyan judge gives doctors 5 days to end their strike. An Afghan border guard killed in clashes with Pakistan, according to officials. And Gambia's new president will return to Banjul. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
University of Arizona doctoral student James Weber loves to run in his bare feet. It was his inspiration to study the mechanics of running. But since it said you've got to walk before you run, Weber has focused his recent research on walking. He incorporates his research into a new study that explores why humans walk heel to toe, while a number of other animal species walk on the balls of their feet. Weber's study suggests that a human's walk boils down to the length of our legs. He explains that since we stand with heels down on the ground, our legs are physically shorter than if we stood on our toes. To become more efficient walkers, we've had to adopt a heel-to-toe style of walking that produces what he calls virtual legs that are longer than actual physical legs. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at a credit card for international students. New U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis becomes the first senior Trump administration official to make a foreign trip. Mattis, confirmed by the Senate just last week, will make stops in Japan and South Korea. The Pentagon said the trip will underscore the commitment of the U.S. to its enduring alliances and further strengthen security cooperation. Mattis will visit Seoul February 1st and Tokyo February 3rd. He's made reaching out to traditional allies a priority in his first days, speaking with the head of the NATO alliance and his defense counterparts in Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand. During the election campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump called on both South Korea and Japan, who host thousands of U.S. troops, to shoulder more of the defense burden. Brad Glosserman, executive director of the Hawaii-based Pacific Forum think tank, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the trip comes at a time of tension in Seoul and Tokyo.
I believe that that reflects a sense of priority that is a product of American interests and, I think, a greater, certainly a powerful and compelling need for the United States to be engaged and to assuage the concerns of allies. It also could mean that they are anticipating an immediate challenge from that part of the world. You go to where you expect you're going to have to be doing something, and so they're laying, I think, groundwork for some of that as well as dampening tensions.
What are the challenges, China, North Korea, or both?
I think both. My sense is the immediate challenge from the administration is going to come from North Korea in the sense that China, I think, is more inclined to wait out the administration to see where it's going to go and not be, if you will, the first opportunity for the new president to throw down the gauntlet. My sense is that North Korea, on the other hand, has a more pressing need for international engagement.
Well, is this because of the intercontinental ballistic missile threat seems to be more imminent?
Imminent, I'm not sure is the right word. I think that there is the prospect of a test. And mind you, I think the official wording from the North Koreans has been merely that they've ended the preparations and that a test could come any time. That doesn't mean that it's actually going to come. I think it's more along the lines that this is a North Korean administration that probably feels a greater need to command American attention and to see what the opportunities are and to try to shape events in ways that they think, rightly or wrongly, are more congenial to North Korean interests.
During the election campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump suggested that Japan share more of the burden for its own defense. What are the issues that Japan and the U.S. face on this trip?
Well, I think that's the immediate one, is the equitable burden sharing. And I think that's a longstanding American complaint that Japan has not done enough, and I think that reflects in many ways an outdated mode of what Japan is doing. It has very substantially upgraded its defense capabilities and is doing a great deal more in the interest of being a good alliance partner and contributor to security in the region. I think the Japanese very much would like to hear Secretary Mattis repeat the explicit commitment to defense of the Senkakus under Article 5 of the Mutual Defense Treaty, which both President Obama and former Secretary of State and Defense have given.
The trip's announcement came as China released a new list of items banned for export to North Korea as part of UN Security Council Resolution 2321 following a North Korean nuclear test in September. The banned exports include so-called dual-use materials and technologies that can be used in the manufacture of weapons such as software programs and certain metals. With more than 1 million international students studying to get a university degree here in the United States, one of the challenges they face is getting approval to obtain a credit card. Banks and other lenders approve credit card requests based on a person's credit history, something a foreign student may have difficulty providing. But now there are lenders that cater to international students by looking at alternative metrics to determine a person's credit worthiness. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on one Silicon Valley lender with immigrant roots.
After leaving Beijing to study in the United States, Jack Guo has learned to navigate a new language, different methods of getting around, and even a new way of managing his money. That means getting a credit card.
A lot of my friends who have had the cards already, because it's pretty important to get around on LA. And also, if you are going to stay here afterwards for job, for internship, for career, yeah, of course, you're going to consider buying a property to live here, and having a credit is pretty important. You want to get a loan.
Unlike many cash-based societies, credit cards are widely used in the United States, especially with the advent of e-commerce, where users with a credit card and a smartphone can buy items and order food or a car ride. But getting an American credit card as an international student is not easy. Traditional U.S. lenders ask for the social security number of applicants and look at their credit history, things most international students don't have.
The traditional system was designed in 20th century before internet, before smartphone, before social media, and it's kind of antiquated. We are inventing a new system.
Kalpesh Kapadia, a former student from India, is the co-founder of CellScore, a lender that issues credit cards to students from abroad.
They have to prove their financial wherewithal to study, and when they come here, they are treated as if they are invisible from the credit system standpoint.
Based in Silicon Valley, CellScore looks at a different kind of data to determine a person's credit worthiness.
Everyone has a smartphone, everyone has a social media presence. So what we look at is that these people have been through many filters in the society.
For filters, CellScore looks at documents presented by the applicant, including acceptance to a school, passport, visa, and ability to pay. Kapadia said fewer than 1% of CellScore's 10,000 credit card holders are delinquent on payments.
This is a highly motivated population. Someone who comes here 10,000 miles away to make their life better through education is going to behave quite differently.
The 15 to 20% who don't pay their total monthly balances are charged high interest, about 19%. Keeping payments current can help them get loans for future large purchases in the U.S., such as a car or home.
One of the benefits I hope to get is, of course, to build this credit, which is very important in terms of you want to get a loan from the bank.
So far, students from more than 66 countries and attending 400 colleges in the U.S. have a CellScore credit card. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Palo Alto, California.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. A new film starring Oscar winner Matthew McConaughey and directed by Academy Award-winning director Stephen Gagan, Gold, tells the story of a small-time operator who strikes it rich. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, Gold is based on the true story of a multi-billion dollar scandal from the 1990s.
I had a dream. It was like I was being called. It was a gold calling. Gold.
Matthew McConaughey plays Kenny Wells, a chain-smoking, pot-bellied, hard-drinking, failed businessman looking for a lucky break. Kenny drinks a lot, and once, in a drunken stupor, has a vision of a gold mine in the jungle. McConaughey says that Kenny is bold, or crazy enough, to follow that dream.
Not doing too well, took over his father's company that was very successful, and he's run it into the ground. He's a guy who literally gets drunk enough that he has a vision. He has a dream one night that there's gold over in this place we've been through some 8 years earlier. And he's brave enough to follow up on that dream.
Kenny teams up with a geologist played by Edgar Ramirez and travels to Indonesia, where he buys a patch of jungle and begins mining. Eventually, they find gold, and Wells makes a big splash on Wall Street as speculation rises that he could own billions of dollars of the precious metal. Matthew McConaughey says he read the script years ago and decided he wanted to make this movie because it has everything he wants in a story.
I read this about over 3 years ago, and it was one of the few scripts luckily that I read that automatically. I said, I have to do this. I have to beat this guy. Kenny Wells, and I love the movie. It's the kind of movie that I want to go see. It's the type of thriller. It's the type of drama. It's got the right type of character that I want to go see. If I've got a choice of 20 pictures, this is the one I'm going to go see. My favorite kind of movies to watch.
Matthew McConaughey, who famously lost a lot of weight for his Oscar-winning role in The Dallas Buyers Club, had to gain nearly 21 kilograms to play Kenny. He wears a bald patch wig for the film, and the actor says he gave himself permission to do what he needed to for the role.
So I just started, and I gave myself the pleasure of saying, you can eat whatever you want, whenever you want. You can drink whatever you want, whenever you want. For 4 months, go for it. And, I don't know, whatever, 2 months later, weighed up to 211 pounds, which my body's never had that on it before, and it feels great. And the idea that there's a certain football coach who I won't give credit to, I go on SportsCenter later on, we're selling this movie in the Big 12, who I was thinking about who the balding head looks like.
Gold is based on the life of Canadian mining prospector David Walsh, whose company Briex did strike gold in Indonesia. The Briex gold operation came crashing down in 1997 when it was discovered that the company did not own the rights to the gold field and that Busan, Indonesia itself did not have much of the precious metal. Canadian pension funds, which had invested in Briex, lost hundreds of millions of dollars. David Walsh died of a brain aneurysm in 1998. Gold also stars Bryce Dallas Howard as Kenny's long-suffering girlfriend Kay. It's directed by Stephen Gagan, the Oscar-winning director of Crash. Gold opens in U.S. theaters January 27th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks very much, David. I guess actor Matthew McConaughey had to sort of suffer for his art there. Oh, well. That's our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After 22 years of autocratic rule under former President Yahya Jammeh, the Gambia has a new president, Adama Barrow. President Barrow's inauguration took place on January 18th at the Gambian embassy in Dakar, Senegal, due to concerns about his safety in Gambia. After initially accepting his electoral defeat in early December, Mr. Jammeh suddenly changed course, refusing to step down. He then attempted to challenge the election results in court, and when that failed, declared a state of emergency. The Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, immediately condemned the attempt by Jammeh to cling to power. Following weeks of high-level engagement by ECOWAS and other regional heads of state, the group underlined their commitment to Gambian democracy by organizing a multinational mission to enforce Gambia's electoral results should Mr. Jammeh continue to refuse to hand over power. Following the stationing of these forces on the Gambian border and intense last-minute mediation by regional leaders, Mr. Jammeh finally agreed to depart peacefully on January 21st. This has paved the way for President Barrow to return to the Gambia imminently. The United States welcomes the ongoing peaceful transition of power in the Gambia and congratulates President Barrow on his inauguration. Mr. Jammeh took office in 1994 after a coup and imprisoned numerous journalists and political opponents during his tenure. President Barrow has vowed to release all political prisoners and to get to work on improving the Gambia's economy. The United States applauds the commitment to democracy and the restraint shown by the Gambian people over the past weeks and appreciates the decision by Mr. Jammeh to depart peacefully. The United States commends the economic community of West African states and other regional partners for their leadership in addressing the situation. The United States echoes President Barrow's call for Gambians to unite and work together as brothers and sisters for the future of the Gambia. The United States is proud of our close ties to the people of the Gambia and looks forward to working closely with President Barrow and his team to achieve the aspirations of all Gambians.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.